This Slate spoiler special is meant to be played after you see the movie being discussed. The podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on The Ides of March, the new George Clooney film, directed by and semi-starring, I would say, supporting role, actually, George Clooney as well. Here in the studio with me is Seth Coulter-Walls. Hey, Seth.
Hi, Dana.
You are. I forgot to identify you last time. I just sort of went, but it was like you were like a one-namer, like Cher or something. But you are a writer for The Village Voice, for Slate on occasion. Where else are you publishing these days?
Washington Post and The All, various places, different every week, double XL.
On music, on movies, on books, on you're a critic at large.
Right.
And a good movie companion. Thanks a lot for coming to see The Ides of March with me last
night. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So I want to recreate, to the extent possible, the exact conversation we had walking down Broadway to a Chinese restaurant after seeing this movie last night, because
right.
I really liked some of the points we were hitting, but I can't remember how it all started. I mean, first of all, just general reaction. I was a little bit disappointed in this movie.
Yeah, I thought it could potentially be better than it was. George Clooney is like a real director. He's not just a vanity project for him, right? He's like can turn in strong work and strong acting possibilities with Gosling and with Clooney also. But I think we both felt that it was actually frustrating on a couple of different levels, both structurally and performance-wise.
Yeah, especially the last half or maybe the last quarter or so. It's a strange movie that pivots in this weird direction. This is why I'm really glad we're spoiling it, because I'm going to have to be all mysterious in my review and hinting about things that happen. And in
right.
fact, to really get at what doesn't work about this movie, you have to give away some plot points.
Yeah, so do we want to do like a quick...
Yeah, let's do a quick summary first of all. Okay, so this is a political thriller, I guess you would say. It's based on a play that I think the playwright Bo Willimon also collaborated on the screenplay with
That's
Clooney
right.
and with Grant Heslov, who co-wrote Good Night and Good Luck with Clooney.
Okay.
And so they tried to open out this play, right, and turn it into a sort of realist movie as opposed to this very claustrophobic drama that it was on stage. It's the story of a Democratic presidential candidate played by Clooney. It's still the primary, right? It's the eve of the primary election. I think it's about 2 weeks before the primary or something.
Yeah, it's in Ohio, and he's a governor. He's a sitting governor, Governor Morris.
Right, but he's the governor of Pennsylvania, I think, right? But they're campaigning
right.
in Ohio.
Right.
He's running against a guy who's just very vaguely sketched, but who seems to be a little bit more to the left, a little bit more progressive than he is. It's also this kind of fantasy universe, by the way, very kind of unrealistic universe in which the Republican side is apparently completely beatable in
right.
this fictional election year.
Right.
So
not worth considering or dramatizing.
Right. There's not even a sketch of sort of the political reality that obtains in this movie. It's just this world in which if you get the Democratic nomination, you're pretty much a shoo-in for president.
Right. I think it's a sort of thinly veiled version of 2008 with an ex post facto gloss of like, okay, so a charismatic Democrat's always going to beat some kind of like, fractious Republican Party that doesn't have a really dynamic candidate.
Right, right.
Which
also comes through in the fact that Clooney's candidate has a Shepard Fairey style poster that you see
exactly.
everywhere in his campaign headquarters. So he's vaguely Obama-esque, but this movie is not terribly concerned with parallels with political reality.
Which is sort of, I think, one of the things that sort of can structurally throw people, because there is this like really decided kind of effort on the part of the filmmakers, especially at the beginning, to create this verisimilitude of like political reality. Like we have a series of, principally MSNBC primetime hosts like Rachel Maddow or Chris Matthews, like thrown into the mix, like interviewing, Paul Giamatti, who's one of the campaign managers for this primary debate. And it's all like meant to be in various ways that are signaled, really truthful and real, except for it doesn't feel that way at all.
Yeah. You were saying that it really throws you to see these MSNBC familiar faces playing themselves in movies.
Yeah. And it's actually, this happened in the Matt Damon movie that came out earlier this year, The Adjustment Bureau. There's, this like 15-minute montage at the beginning of as many politicos as you could throw at it. And it's strange because these people are terrible movie actors. They can't even play themselves well. There's like this slight sense in which it doesn't even really feel like their shows. If you watch Chris Matthews do his show live, and then you watch him playing himself on TV or in a movie, he's nowhere near as demonstrative.
Is there
Chris
any
Matthews
chance
like.
That we can get a minute of your Chris Matthews impersonation here?
Ha! Ha! Let me tell you. Hey, what's up? Hey, like, no, let me ask you this. Ha! Anyway,
the barking laugh. You've got the barking laugh down perfectly,
right.
And he doesn't let loose that way. In when he plays himself,
so
in a
sedate,
movie.
and it's confusing because you're taken out of the movie. When I first recognized Rachel Maddow, I was like, oh, Rachel Maddow's covering this, and I missed a key character name for a few moments. And was anyway. But what's, I think, odd about this, not just that people don't play themselves as well as they are in real life, actually, which isn't, I don't think, a huge surprise, but when the movie deviates later from any kind of recognizable political reality or just baseline things about cynicism and politics and experience that we're well, I think, inured to at this point, when the characters don't behave in ways that conform to how we think we know how political operatives work, it's that much more sort of shocking and strangely clashing.
Yeah, it can't really make up its mind whether it wants to be a vague allegory that's gesturing at truths, trans-historical truths about politics, or to be some kind of a specific parable about what's happening in politics now.
Right.
But okay, so we have to get into to what happens to
plot,
this George
right.
Clooney guy. So he has two campaign managers, right? His head campaign manager is played by Philip Seymour Hoffman as this sort of, I don't know what real character you would compare him to, but he's a very K Street operative kind of guy, right?
And like battle scarred and kind of, you know, real politic.
Battle scarred, real politic, and thoroughly inured to the whole campaign process, but extremely loyal, right? He's not a bad guy. He's not sort
right.
of shown as a Karl Rovian evil figure. He's actually extremely loyal. In fact, his loyalty becomes a big plot point in his obsession with others' loyalty because
right.
he's kind of a paranoid. But he runs the campaign. And his very close right-hand man, played by Ryan Gosling, character's
right.
name is Steven, I think.
Who apparently doesn't work for the campaign per se, but works sort of as a consultant, which is, you know, structurally just sort of weird. Like, he wouldn't be the number two and not actually be on the campaign payroll. But.
Yeah, that's a point that seems important to him, is that he works for Paul. He works for this character played by Philip Seymour Hoffman
right.
and not for the candidate. But as the movie begins, we're supposed to believe this some stuff about Ryan Gosling's character that, to me, not only seems implausible that such a person could exist, but makes his turn later in the movie completely implausible, which is that essentially he's kind of a dewy-eyed idealist who truly, truly believes in this candidate, will stick by him through anything, and essentially can't envision his career doing anything else but sort of getting this man into power so he can change the world.
Right, exactly. And it's strange, too, because he, at the same time in the first act, tells another, I think it's a reporter, I forget who he says this to, but he advertises of himself that he's worked on so many campaigns at this point in his life. He's 30, but he's worked on more campaigns than most people who are in campaigns and are 40 years old, which as a matter of math is somewhat, you know, strange because it's the same number of, like, electoral cycles in a year for everybody. So it's, like,
right.
it's actually sort of like one of these things that maybe people tell about themselves who are telling.
Well, he works on the dog catcher campaign in his
right,
off
okay.
years.
No, I guess I wasn't factoring that in. But anyway, it's strange. And so, I mean, we're spoiling it. You know, there's this turn and he's not, a favored member of the campaign anymore. He's pushed out and retaliates, you know, in a way that we'll get to. But he has to make this break with his sincerity, as he's described it in the first act, which you would think would come much earlier in a professional political operative's life, especially one who was so working double time on as many campaigns as everybody else.
Right. I mean, I think a movie that had more complex ideas to explore about politics than this one would explore the way in which you can be an idealist in your ultimate goals, you know,
right.
but in the short term, you know, in the means to the end, you have to be an operative. And I think that's probably the case with anyone who would rise that high in a campaign. I'm sure that all of Obama's right-hand men believed in him deeply, but that doesn't mean that they weren't, you know, utterly scurrilous in what they were willing to do to get him elected.
Right. And the things that George Clooney cannot abide include giving a cabinet post to a senator with a key endorsement to give during the primary season. He just can't deal with this character played by Jeffrey Wright, who's another senator who, you know, apparently his views about the UN or so anathema to George Clooney's own, that he cannot give him the chit that he needs in order to get all of his delegates and put the nomination out of reach for this other character. But that's not even the biggest twist, right? I mean, the biggest twist is that there's this young woman who's an intern on the campaign who is the daughter of the DNC chair. And
played by Evan Rachel Wood.
Played by
say.
Evan Rachel Wood, right. And she ends up coming on so strong to Ryan Gosling in one of the campaign office interior scenes. You know, she's like putting it all out there that she wants to, you know, have sex with him. And he kind of responds. She actually does some good work in the movie.
I love Evan Rachel Wood. I've always
really
liked
good.
Her a lot.
So even though there was this, you know, so she, there's actually a really funny moment where she's tying his tie in the bedroom and it goes on for a really long time. Did you remember that?
Yeah. This is a sweet moment.
It's a really sweet moment. It's actually both sweet and funny. And I thought one of the best performed pieces of the movie, but she's psyching him up to go into the office and sort of saying that they don't need to really talk about the fact that they just slept together the night before and that it's fine, you know, and that he doesn't have to worry about her. And then you sort of have a subconscious sense that it's taking a long time for her to tie his tie, you know, in reverse in front of him. And he says, you don't have no idea how to tie a tie, do you? And I thought that was like the funniest part of the movie.
I mean, there's some stuff at the beginning that's just really setting up a movie that never happens. Like
right.
their relationship has a little bit of substance. And then as
yeah.
soon as the twist, which we'll get to, comes along, it's all emptied out. And so the other competition for Ryan Gosling that's going on, besides Evan Rachel Wood trying to land him in bed, which is relatively easy for her to do.
Right.
Paul Giamatti, who plays the manager of the opponent's campaign, is also trying to seduce. Well, we think at first he's trying to seduce Ryan Gosling to work for his side.
Right.
So they have this fateful meeting, a
right.
meeting that changes everything.
In a bar,
which Ryan Gosling doesn't tell anyone about because he's essentially embarrassed to be meeting with the opposition. And after an initial attempt to poach him and get him to come and work for his side, Paul Giamatti then gives up and leaves him with the information that, you want to spoil this point because I don't remember it exactly. I guess that Jeffrey Wright is about to
that Jeffrey Wright's character is going to endorse the other candidate. But it's very complex in its way that I think actually sort of will flatter a lot of professional political operatives, because it makes the notion of who is, like, you know, two or three steps down from campaign manager is the most important political news of the world, right? This, like, whole sort of, like, very dense and almost, like, it sort of reminds me, like, in its complexity, like, the way that a lot of these movies about very big issues, like a traffic or like a Syriana, try to make a virtue out of this sort of needless bureaucratic complexity. And that feels like that's, like, embedded in this plot a little bit. Like, Paul Giamatti advertises to Philip Seymour Hoffman that he might one day want to steal somebody of Ryan Gosling's gifts. And then after sort of planting that seed, calls Gosling directly to have a sit down with him, all of which is his broad machination in order to make Philip Seymour Hoffman no longer trust Ryan Gosling, so that Ryan Gosling gets pushed out of the George Clooney campaign.
Right, so the meeting was just to have a meeting. It was just so that it could be
to sow discord, right? And so
I have to say that my favorite moment of the movie, maybe my tie moment, is that gaze that Paul Giamatti and Philip Seymour Hoffman exchange from the wings as their two candidates are debating near the beginning. There's just this glare these two, like, angry, chubby operatives, you know, each sort of fiercely battening down on their side, and they just give each other this tight smile and this nod, and it's hilarious.
No, that is a good moment. But there, like, all of this complexity in terms of the plot sort of, I think, is in the service of, like, very little. Do you know what I mean?
Well, because the key twist, and here's where the plot pivots to this weird place, right, is that dewy-eyed Ryan Gosling finds out by
sleeping with the intern, the 20-year-old intern who's the daughter of the DNC chair.
Answers her phone by mistake because they all have these campaign cell phones.
Right.
And it turns out that it's Clooney's character. It's the candidate on the line. Here's a plot point. Why didn't he recognize his voice, right? He talks to George Clooney 100 times a day on the phone.
No, that's, like, not – that reckoning does not happen until the third act, but it should have been something that was immediately recognizable, right, for Clooney and for
– Right.
Also, the same thing is true of Gosling. He has to look at the phone to figure out – he has to call the number back. And then he says that somebody asked for her by name.
Right.
But he didn't recognize the guy who's on the cover of Time and the poster saying, this be our next president, right?
It's strange. It seems like they would recognize each other's voices immediately. But, okay, so then he discovers that she has also had at least one sexual encounter with the candidate.
Which ends up needing a $900 abortion, like, as the follow-up plot point to it, that she, you know, can't ask her father for, the DNC chair, because they are Catholic.
Another plot point that doesn't make sense to me, because why would he go into petty cash, which he does, the campaign petty cash, and actually letting some fellow campaign members know that he's going to get the petty cash for something that he won't reveal, rather than just pay her out of his own pocket? I mean, $900 is $900. Surely he's as number three, you know, as the David Axelrod of the campaign, he's making enough that he could just shut her up with his own money.
Yeah, this is, like, another part of the sort of political verisimilitude that this movie's really fuzzy about. Like, it's, you know, sometimes he's presented as somebody who's, like, a young, scrappy up-and-comer, you know, and doesn't have, like, a ton of money and will make money in the future when he becomes, you know, post-White House lobbyist. But it ignores the fact that anybody at this, like, elite level in professional politics is already not worried about that type of month-to-month kind of petty cash thing. But at any rate, and also that petty cash thing does not result in any kind of follow-up plot point, right?
Yeah,
like,
you're right.
I remember you tensed up when you were sort of like, I can't believe the stupidity of this.
Yeah, I was whispering.
This is clearly the house of cards upon which this Watergate will tumble. And then you were like, why is he doing the petty? And it's like, man, nothing happens with that.
He got away with that. So he gives her the petty cash. She gets the abortion. He immediately breaks it off with her. And actually, I thought there was a good scene where he gets very icy with her and sort of says, like, you know, the campaign comes before you. Basically, you fucked up and, you know, take the money and get your abortion and get out of town. It's pretty cold.
But at the same time that he takes Evan Rachel Wood to the abortion clinic, drops her off after he's been cold with her, and says that he'll be there to pick her up when she's ready to be ferried home, right? Except for what happens in the interim. And this, I thought, was sort of strange at the time, too. Like, why not just stay? You know what I mean? Like, it's, like, weird to, like, double back and then go back, like, make two trips to the abortion clinic. Even from, like, but the reason that this happens, right, is because something has to happen to Ryan Gosling while Evan Rachel Wood is having her abortion, which is that he gets pushed out of the George Clooney campaign as a result of his meeting with Paul
Giamatti. Basically has a screaming match with Philip Seymour Hoffman. Philip Seymour Hoffman finds out that he's seen Paul Giamatti, and says you're off the campaign. And then in an interesting – at the time, actually, I thought this was kind of a cool way to handle it.
Revealing what you were just saying. He doesn't have a screaming match on camera.
Right.
We're only told later that he freaks out.
We see him get told. We see him sort of, you know, silent and in horror that he's been kicked off this campaign that is his whole life.
Right.
And then we hear later in somebody else's voicemail message, oh, he completely went off on Philip Seymour Hoffman. And suddenly – here's the pivot. Okay, here's the pivot. Suddenly Ryan Gosling, who's been this dewy-eyed, tender political idealist, becomes this icy psychopath. He'll do anything to bring down not only Philip Seymour Hoffman, that would make sense, but to bring down his candidate.
Right, right. It becomes like a samurai thing where he like sort of, you know, takes on this latitude of eyebrow that cannot be raised. No matter, do you know what I mean? And he sort of like walks around like a steely.
This makes me wish you'd seen Drive. You haven't seen Drive
yet.
No,
not yet, yeah.
Because it's sort of on a more macro scale, on a more coarsely handled scale, this is sort of what happens in Drive, where you can't decide whether his character is an evil psychopath or this gentle, kind of implacable, powerful man or whatever. And it happens in a more granular way, in a way that makes more sense in Drive. And it's also just a more stylized movie that's sort of taking place on a different plane.
Right.
But in this movie, I just felt like the movie lost claim to all psychological realism at the moment he became political samurai dude.
And he's not even convincing in that realm because he's so – I mean the performance and weirdly I think the direction of all of this toward the end really loses all of the bearings. Like at the moment when Ryan Gosling is triumphant, he successfully displaces Philip Seymour Hoffman as campaign head.
By blackmailing George Clooney.
By blackmailing the candidate that he wants to work for but no longer destroy now that he can destroy the person who fired him from the campaign in the first place. He doesn't project outwardly the type of joie de vivre as a political operative that we're told in the beginning is his métier, what makes him work. You know, the New York Times journalist played by Marisa Tomei, right, who tells him, you know, and also Paul Giamatti at the beginning tells him he's so successful because he's such a charmer.
Which we see all through the first, I would say, relatively good three quarters of the movie.
But then in the end, when he's risen to the actual level of campaign manager, he's no longer within shouting distance of anybody's definition of charming. He's like, you know, so dour and kind of like
kind of reptilian.
Yeah, and at the like, you know, blowing past people and kind of like giving these like, you know, little kiss offs at the end of every scene to everybody, you know, and just becoming kind of like, you know, a straightforwardly like remarkable asshole. And at the very end of the movie, he's sitting. As, you know, it's essentially, we're sort of suggested that it's a fait accompli that now Clooney will win. He's taken the endorsement.
He got the delegates.
He actually made the guy that he wouldn't make Secretary of State. He put Jeffrey Wright on his ticket as his VP. So we're supposed to know that it's all going to happen. And they're doing one of these cutaways in a gymnasium, and it's John King from CNN being piped over Ryan Gosling's earpiece, like over his IFB, and he's saying, you know, now we go to campaign manager, you know, Ryan Gosling, and it's a video feed. There's a CNN like camera in front of Ryan Gosling, and he looks like, you know, a prophet of doom. He doesn't look like a smiling campaign.
And that's
manager.
The last shot of the movie, right? So it's Steven so and so, campaign manager.
Right.
What do you have to say? Oh, and I know the question.
You're the winner.
Tell us how this happened. How did you win Ohio?
Right. And if he's really as reptilian and sort of like, you know, become accustomed to cynicism as we're led to expect his character has become, he's at this point really. I mean, I think the only response is that if he's on TV, he'd be smiling and being like, well, this is a result of a lot of hard work. And that would be
a more powerful ending.
That would even be just more cynical, right? But this movie doesn't quite have the courage of its attempt to be dark, which I think was both of our... Like,
well, it also just implies that he's a really ineffectual campaign manager at that point. Like,
right.
You don't want your campaign manager to stare icily into the camera. You want him to chirp something in your favor.
Right. Or else it's the other direction, right? Like, it's like that's his moment of break with, like, you know, reality where he becomes like, you know, where he goes Bullworth potentially, right? Where he's like, you know, this is all messed up or whatever. But just like this is a weird middle ground that doesn't have any particular kind of bite or truth to it.
I also felt that the scene where this is a very weak point in the movie and maybe the lowest point of the pivot of the end is when he meets up with George Clooney in that restaurant kitchen and basically blackmails him. This is a scene that he shows up and says, look, make me your campaign manager. Make me the new Philip Seymour Hoffman
right. Or
else I go public with all this stuff about the abortion. And we didn't even mention the biggest spoiler of all. And I think this is something interpolated into the movie that's not in the play, that Evan Rachel Wood kills herself.
When she realizes when she's not picked up at the abortion clinic and has to take a cab back to the hotel.
That's a crappy day.
Yeah,
it's a very crappy day.
She gets a voicemail from the sort of cherubic number five who's going to briefly be vaulted up to the number two position under Philip Seymour Hoffman until it's the case that Ryan Gosling successfully blackmails George Clooney. She gets this succession of voicemails where she's learning that Gosling was fired.
And the whole thing went down while she was in the clinic, right?
Gosling's going to take revenge on the campaign, and she intuits correctly that his ammo is related to her pregnancy and her dalliance with George Clooney. And then just sort of like out of nowhere, she takes a bunch of pills and drinks and, you know, we're led to believe she commits suicide as a sort of way of preventing shame from descending upon the entire. And she leaves a voicemail also for Ryan Gosling. But this is also a central problem is that way too much emotional information in the movie is either hidden from us. via like these, you know, ellipses or cuts, or like when George Clooney fires Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's all like, you know, he's asked to walk inside of a van and then the camera just lingers in medium shot outside the van for about 45 seconds and then Philip Seymour Hoffman walks out.
Unlike you, I kind of liked that ellipsis. In fact, I liked the ellipses in general. I think he leaned too much on that point. I think he probably saw some cool European movie that had important emotional moments elided and he thought, I'm going to elide my emotional moments. And so he wrote it a little bit too hard. But I bet I liked some of those.
Well, I mean, I think they would have been fine if it, I guess my diagnosis is I thought they were, you know, maybe cool rhythmically, like the first time I saw them. But then when I realized I didn't know why characters were doing things in the third act.
The one that doesn't make any sense is that we don't see Ryan Gosling's turn. But I don't know that it would be possible to dramatize that effectively since it makes no sense.
Well, right. So it ends up feeling more like a cheat, like these stylish ellipses that are executed here for the sake of like sort of emotional like restraint and kind of coolness end up, I think, really structurally hampering the movie to a point where we can't imagine how Ryan Gosling would have pivoted in that scene where he got fired from the sort of like slightly disbelieving, sarcastic guy.
It's like you need a CGI Hulk kind of moment.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't, I mean, so anyway, yeah.
But I mean, for all that we're kind of like crapping all over this movie, I actually scene by scene and minute by minute pretty much enjoyed it, although there was significant eye rolling in the last quarter. I mean, I wouldn't say people should flock to see it, but if you like your Clooney and your Gosling and your sort of semi-smart but not as smart as it thinks it is political thriller, it's not the worst.
Yeah, that's such damnation by praise. If you like your dumb, slightly disbelieving in its own smartness, then this is the movie for you.
Well, I prefer this movie, but a movie like Quiz Show, right? Robert Redford's Quiz Show. Not quite as smart a movie as it thinks it is.
Right.
Totally pleasurable to watch unfold in the moment.
Yeah, I think it's pretty pleasurable. Everybody's, you know, like in terms of like the limitations of the script and everything, they do a good job inhabiting what's there on the page. Yeah.
But I think that the kind of, you know, Oscar level recognition that this movie is clamoring for, I don't think it will get, and I don't think it should get, although maybe some of the smaller roles. Philip Seymour Hoffman's always great, and Paul Giamatti, so funny in a very small role as a very Karl Rovian dude.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the supporting stuff was all really fun to watch, and I mean, it's almost impossible, I think, to put Giamatti or Philip Seymour Hoffman on screen and not have them, you know, do something interesting with it.
Can I also recommend, I don't usually endorse things during spoilers, but I'm also thinking of the Robert Altman TV series Tanner 88, which is just like one of the greatest representations of a campaign. Did you ever see
that
show?
Yeah, yeah, I did. I actually saw that DVD in your house, and I was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote on it because there was a 20 years after revisitation or something like that Altman did, but it's completely worth catching up with. And actually, I think a lot about, you know, about various machinations that happen in that show when I see real-life things unfolding in the campaign, whereas I don't think that this movie is going to change the way I think about anything that happens in the 2012 campaign.
Well, strangely, I don't think it's even meant to. Like, I think all of this drapery of, like, seriousness and sophistication is just, like, seriously window dressing.
Yeah, the idea that they're selling essentially is something that, you know, we could come to independent of any political reality, which is just something about compromise in politics drags us all down in the end.
Right, or just like, you know, power
corrupts.
Tough, or, you know, power's a tough thing to grab hold of. You know,
right. Like. All right, well, next time I'll take you to a better one, I promise.
Thanks. Well, you obviously know ahead of time which movies are going to be good and which movies are going to be bad, right?
Oh, yeah, it's my intuition. I can trust it every time, except on this one. Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.